Hello, this is Chris Wilhelm, and for the next hour, I'll be reading from the Friday, October 17th issue of the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Our headline today, John Bolton Indicted Over Handling of Classified Information. Mr. Bolton, a Trump aide turned critic, is part of a string of presidential foes to become prosecutorial targets, but his case gained momentum in the Biden administration. By Devlin Barrett, Glenn Thrush, and Minho Kim. John R. Bolton, the national security hawk and former advisor to President Trump, who became one of his most outspoken critics, was indicted by a federal grand jury in Maryland on Thursday on charges of mishandling classified information. The indictment against Mr. Bolton was 18 counts and accused him of using personal email and a messaging app to share more than 1,000 pages of diary notes about his day-to-day activities as Mr. Trump's national security advisor in 2018 and 2019. The notes, which were sent to two family members who did not have security clearances, included national defense information, such as details classified as top secret, according to the indictment. President Trump and his former aide parted bitterly toward the end of his first term, and the president greeted the news with grim satisfaction. "He's a bad guy," Mr. Trump said in response to a question from a reporter at the White House about Mr. Bolton. "That's the way it goes." While Mr. Bolton is part of a string of perceived enemies of the president to become prosecutorial targets, the federal investigation into him gained momentum during the Biden administration, when U.S. intelligence agencies gathered what former officials have described as troubling evidence. The prosecution appeared to follow normal department channels, without firings or forced transfers. Kelly O. Hayes, the U.S. attorney in Maryland, was among the career prosecutors to sign off on the charges in conjunction with the Justice Department's National Security Division. By contrast, Mr. Trump, in recent weeks, has removed or sidelined prosecutors in order to secure indictments against two of his longtime targets, James B. Comey, the former FBI director, and Letitia James, New York's attorney general. If convicted of the charges, Mr. Bolton, 76, could spend the rest of his life in prison. Each count carries a maximum potential sentence of 10 years. Mr. Bolton is expected to surrender to the authorities on Friday and make his initial court appearance in Greenbelt, Maryland later that day. Attorney General Pam Bondi welcomed the charges against Mr. Bolton. "Anyone who abuses a position of power and jeopardizes our national security will be held accountable," she said. "No one is above the law." Mr. Bolton, in a statement, declared that the indictment was part of an intimidation campaign against critics of Mr. Trump. "I look forward to the fight to defend my lawful conduct and to expose his abuse of power," he said. The two family members who received Mr. Bolton's notes were not identified in the 26-page indictment, but prosecutors said Mr. Bolton occasionally used his AOL and Google email accounts to send notes to them. Mr. Bolton's written descriptions of where he learned information often indicated that he recognized that he was describing carefully guarded government secrets, the indictment added. One entry by Mr. Bolton began, "The intel briefer said," while another read, "While in the Situation Room, I learned..." Making matters worse, Mr. Bolton's emails were later hacked by someone associated with the government of Iran, the indictment said. A representative for Bolton notified the U.S. government of the hack in or about July 2021, but did not tell the U.S. government that the account contained national defense information, including classified information, that Bolton had placed in the account from his time as national security advisor, according to the filing. One surreal section of the indictment described Mr. Bolton apparently being taunted by his hacker. A message on July 25, 2021 warned, "I do not think you would be interested in the FBI being aware of the leaked content of John's email, some of which have been attached." The email went on to declare, "This could be the biggest scandal since Hillary's emails were leaked, but this time on the GOP side. Contact me before it's too late." A representative for Mr. Bolton forwarded the email to the FBI. The indictment laid out exchanges between Mr. Bolton and the two family members that made it clear he was meticulously assembling a record with their help, with the intent of turning it into a book. all three knew they needed to be discreet. A day after Mr. Bolton joined the White House in April 2018, the indictment said, they started using an encrypted messaging app. Why are we using this now, the encryption? One of Mr. Bolton's correspondents asked. Yep, the other responded. Mr. Bolton then chimed in, for diary in the future. The charging document laid out a number of 20 to 50 page documents that Mr. Bolton sent to the two people over the app. After sending one 24-page document about his time as the National Security Advisor, Mr. Bolton followed up with a message that read, none of which we talked about. One of the recipients wrote back, shh. Mr. Bolton's lawyer, Abby Lowell, said in a statement that the facts of the case were investigated and resolved years ago. Mr. Bolton, like many public officials, kept diaries. That is not a crime, Mr. Lowell added. Those diaries, Mr. Lowell said, were unclassified records that were shared only with his immediate family and known to the FBI as far back as 2021. In August, FBI agents searched Mr. Bolton's Maryland home and his office in Washington, carrying out boxes of papers, computer files, and other materials as part of the investigation. Subsequent court filings indicated that some documents with low-level classification markings were found. Thursday's filing said that printed versions of Mr. Bolton's diary entries, which contained classified information, were found in the search of his home. The New York Times had previously reported that the United States gathered data from an adversary's spy service, including emails with sensitive information that Mr. Bolton, while working in the first Trump administration, appeared to have sent to people close to him on an unclassified system, the people said, speaking on the condition of anonymity to discuss a sensitive case. Mr. Bolton apparently sent the messages to people close to him who were helping him gather material that he would use in his 2020 memoir, The Room Where It Happened, which offered a highly critical behind-the-scenes look at the Trump administration. None of the classified information described in the indictment was mentioned in the book, according to the filing, which said that Mr. Bolton shared intelligence about a foreign adversary's plan for a future missile launch, a covert action in a foreign country, and sensitive sources and methods used to collect intelligence. Mr. Bolton had been a prolific television pundit for more than a decade, and Thursday's indictment used some of his own statements against him, including his declaration that if he had done what Hillary Clinton did in using a private email server as Secretary of State, I'd be in jail right now. Prosecutors also cited his criticism of the Trump administration earlier this year when it was disclosed that officials had used Signal, a commercial messaging app, to discuss an upcoming military strike in Yemen. I couldn't find a way to express how stunned I was that anybody would do this, he said in April. You simply don't use commercial means of communication, whether it's supposedly an encrypted app or not, for these kinds of discussions. While the Bolton case has taken a number of unexpected turns over the years, it stretches back to the waning days of the first Trump administration, when White House officials were furious that Mr. Bolton had written the book. Shortly before Mr. Bolton's memoir was published, the administration went to court seeking to delay its release. The Justice Department, around that time, also opened a criminal investigation into whether Mr. Bolton had mishandled classified information by disclosing certain details in the book. A judge later concluded that he might have published classified information, but the criminal investigation appeared to languish until the intelligence about his emails was gathered years later. A 2021 settlement of the litigation over the book included the condition that Mr. Bolton return to the government any material in his possession that may contain classified information, the indictment said. Earlier this year, John Ratcliffe, the CIA director, briefed Kash Patel, the FBI director, on the information collected about Mr. Bolton's emails. The officials believed that the material Mr. Bolton had transcribed into the unclassified and unsecured email contained classified information. Each intelligence agency makes its own determinations about what information is classified, so it is often up to the originating agency to decide whether pieces of information are classified and how sensitive they are. Mr. Bolton was investigated under the Espionage Act, a 1917 law that has, in recent years, taken on an outsized role in American politics, as investigators have pursued similar cases against high-profile officials or candidates. During the 2016 presidential campaign, Mrs. Clinton was investigated for her use of a private email server to handle her work as Secretary of State. In 2022, FBI agents searched Mr. Trump's Mar-a-Lago home in Florida and found more than 100 classified documents, in addition to others retrieved earlier. Mr. Trump was indicted in that case, but the charges were dismissed by a trial judge during the 2024 presidential campaign. And in early 2023, the Justice Department appointed a special counsel to investigate how classified documents had ended up in President Joseph R. Biden Jr.'s office and home after he left the vice presidency. Carbon dioxide levels jumped by a record amount, UN says. Surging emissions from wildfires may have been behind the increase, which was the largest since modern measurements began more than half a century ago, by Raymond Zong and Sachi Kitajima-Mulki. The average level of carbon dioxide in the Earth's atmosphere climbed by the largest amount on record between 2023 and 2024, the World Meteorological Organization said on Thursday. Human activities, mainly the burning of coal, oil, and gas for energy, have been driving carbon dioxide concentrations higher and higher for more than half a century. This has warmed the Earth rapidly, as carbon dioxide and other greenhouse gases cause energy from the sun to remain trapped near the planet's surface. Last year was the Earth's hottest year in recorded history. Human-caused emissions remained the major driver of the record recent jump in carbon dioxide levels, the largest since modern measurements began in 1957, according to the organization, which is the Weather and Climate Agency of the United Nations. In 2024, the atmosphere's average concentration of the gas reached 423.9 parts per million, an increase of 3.5 parts per million from the year before. That edged out a 3.3 parts per million increase in 2016 that was previously the largest ever measured. Year-to-year rises in carbon dioxide concentrations have accelerated since the 1960s, when the average pace of increase was 0.8 parts per million. An uptick in emissions from wildfires was likely to have played a role in 2024's record jump, as was decreased absorption of carbon dioxide by the land and the ocean, the agency said. Severe drought and forest fires can degrade the ability of soil and plants to draw down carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, while rising ocean temperatures lessen seawater's capacity to harbor the gas. Carbon dioxide that is not absorbed by the land or by the seas can remain in the atmosphere for centuries, influencing the climate long after its original release into the skies. The heat trapped by CO2 and other greenhouse gases is turbocharging our climate and leading to more extreme weather, Coe Barrett, the World Meteorological Organization's Deputy Secretary General, said in a statement. Reducing emissions is therefore essential, not just for our climate, but also for our economic security and community well-being. Since 1960, humankind has released roughly 500 billion tons of carbon into the atmosphere. China is the world's top emitter today, though when adding up emissions from the whole of the industrial era, the United States comes out on top. Under President Trump, the nation is retreating from measuring and reporting its emissions. In April, the Environmental Protection Agency missed an annual deadline to submit data on planet warming pollution to the UN. In September, the agency said it would stop requiring thousands of polluting facilities to report the amount of greenhouse gases they released into the air. At his address to the UN General Assembly later last month, Mr. Trump lashed out at allies around the world while dismissing the dangers of climate change. Mr. Trump's proposed budget would shut down carbon dioxide monitoring, observatories, and satellites run by federal agencies, including the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration and NASA. In June, the National Institute of Standards and Technology canceled grant funding for a large emissions monitoring effort across multiple American cities. The Trump administration has also taken steps to repeal the endangerment finding, which provides the scientific foundation for regulating polluters by concluding that greenhouse gases threaten public health. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Head of the U.S. military's Southern Command is stepping down, officials say. Admiral Alvin Holsey is leaving less than a year into his tenure, and as the Pentagon escalates attacks against boats in the Caribbean Sea, by Eric Schmidt and Tyler Pager. The military commander overseeing the Pentagon's escalating attacks against boats in the Caribbean Sea that the Trump administration says are smuggling drugs said on Thursday that he was stepping down. The officer, Admiral Alvin Holsey, is leaving his job as head of the U.S. Southern Command, which oversees all operations in Central and South America, even as the Pentagon has rapidly built up some 10,000 forces in the region in what it says is a major counter-drug and counter-terrorism mission. It was unclear why Admiral Holsey is suddenly departing, less than a year into what is typically a three-year job, and in the midst of the biggest operation in his 37-year career. But one current and one former U.S. official, both of whom spoke on the condition of anonymity to discuss personnel matters, said that Admiral Holsey had raised concerns about the mission and the attacks on the alleged drug boats. In a statement on social media, Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth made no mention of any friction with his four-star commander. On behalf of the Department of War, said Mr. Hegseth, using the name of the department he now prefers, we extend our deepest gratitude to Admiral Alvin Holsey for his more than 37 years of distinguished service to our nation as he plans to retire at year's end. Nor did Admiral Holsey publicly voice any policy objections, urging his command's 1,200 military service members and civilians in a statement, "Keep charging." But other officials at the Pentagon and on Capitol Hill said the praise masked real policy tensions concerning Venezuela that the admiral and his civilian boss were seeking to paper over. "Prior to Trump, I can't think of a combat commander who left his or her post early, ever," said Representative Adam Smith of Washington, a senior Democrat on the House Armed Services Committee. Senator Jack Reed of Rhode Island, the top Democrat on the Senate Armed Services Committee, was even more pointed in his criticism. "At a moment when U.S. forces are building up across the Caribbean and tensions with Venezuela are at a boiling point, the departure of our top military commander in the region sends an alarming signal of instability within the chain of command," Mr. Reed said in a statement. Since early September, U.S. Special Operations Forces have struck at least five boats off the Venezuelan coast that the White House says were transporting drugs, killing 27 people. American officials have privately made it clear that the main goal is to drive Nicolas Maduro, Venezuela's authoritarian leader, from power. But a range of specialists in the laws governing the use of force have disputed the Trump administration's claim that it can lawfully kill people suspected of drug trafficking like enemy troops instead of arresting them for prosecution. As a matter of domestic law, Congress has not authorized any armed conflict. As a matter of international law, for a non-state group to qualify as a belligerent in an armed conflict, meaning its members can be targeted for killing based on their status alone, not because of anything they specifically do, it must be an organized armed group with a centralized command structure and engaging in hostilities. Admiral Holsey, who is black, becomes the latest in a line of more than a dozen military leaders, many of them people of color and women, who have left their jobs this year. Most have been fired by Mr. Hegseth or pushed out. Mr. Hegseth fired the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Charles Q. Brown, Jr., who is black, the first woman to command the Navy, Admiral Lisa Franchetti, and the U.S. military's representative to the NATO Military Committee, Vice Admiral Shoshana Chatfield. He also pushed out Lieutenant General Jeffrey A. Cruz, the head of the Defense Intelligence Agency. Others have not fit into the mold of what Mr. Hegseth considers a leader in his Pentagon. In August, the Air Force's top uniformed officer, General David Alvin, announced that he would retire early, 2 years into a four-year term. About 2 weeks ago, Mr. Hegseth summoned hundreds of generals and admirals from around the world to a meeting at Marine Corps Base Quantico in Northern Virginia. It was a gathering without precedent in recent memory. The secretary told the senior officers that he was tightening standards for fitness and grooming, cracking down even more rigorously on woke garbage and rejected the notion of toxic leadership. It was not clear on Thursday who would replace Admiral Halsey, who just this week visited the island countries Antigua and Barbuda and Grenada. News of the admiral's departure comes a day after the New York Times reported that the Trump administration had secretly authorized the CIA to conduct covert action in Venezuela. President Trump acknowledged on Wednesday that he had authorized the covert action and said the United States was considering strikes on Venezuelan territory. All of these developments come as the U.S. military is planning its own possible escalation, drawing up options for Mr. Trump to consider, including strikes inside Venezuela. While Admiral Halsey has been the highest-ranking military officer overseeing the airstrikes, the decision to carry them out has been driven by the White House, and the strikes themselves have been conducted by special operations forces, with Admiral Halsey largely cut out of the decision-making. Any operation to intervene militarily in Venezuela, especially without congressional authorization, would be unwise and dangerous, Mr. Reed said. Admiral Halsey's resignation only deepens my concern that this administration is ignoring the hard-earned lessons of previous U.S. military campaigns and the advice of our most experienced warfighters. The Trump administration has justified its attack on drug smuggling suspects as national self-defense at a time of high overdose deaths in the United States, but the surge in overdoses has been driven by fentanyl, which comes from Mexico, not South America. The size and scope of the U.S. military buildup in the Caribbean region is significant. There are now about 10,000 U.S. troops, most of them at bases in Puerto Rico, but also some 2,200 Marines on amphibious assault ships. In all, the Navy has 8 warships and a submarine in the Caribbean. Admiral Halsey's abrupt end to leading one of the military's highly coveted regional warfighting commands comes after a Navy career that started with his commissioning through the Naval Reserve Officers Training Corps, or NROTC, at Morehouse College in Atlanta in 1988. The admiral, a native of Fort Valley, Georgia, worked his way up from commanding helicopter squadrons to leading one of the Navy's prestigious aircraft carrier strike groups. He first served as the Southern Command's military deputy before taking command in November 2024. In a message posted on the Southern Command's X account, Admiral Halsey did not explain why he was stepping down. The Southcom team has made lasting contributions to the defense of the nation and will continue to do so, he said. I am confident that you will forge ahead, focused on your mission that strengthens our nation and ensures its longevity as a beacon of freedom around the globe. France's government narrowly survives no confidence vote. The result gives Sébastien Lecornu, France's prime minister, a reprieve after weeks of political turmoil, but he still has to get a budget passed by the end of the year. By Aurélien Breeden. France's government survived a crucial no-confidence vote in Parliament on Thursday by a thin margin, giving the country a brief respite from political turmoil before what is expected to be another brutal battle over its budget. The no-confidence motion, which was filed by the far-left France Unbowed party, drew the support of 271 lawmakers in the 577-seat lower house, shy of the absolute majority of 289 votes required to topple Prime Minister Sébastien Lecornu and his cabinet. A second no-confidence motion, filed by the far-right National Rally Party, received less support, with only 144 lawmakers voting in favor. Mr. Lecornu's survival gave France a moment to breathe after weeks of political instability that plunged the country into deep uncertainty over its future and weighed on its economy. Had the no-confidence motions against Mr. Lecornu succeeded, it would have been the second time in less than 2 weeks that the government had collapsed. This is obviously the moment of truth, Mr. Lecornu told lawmakers before the vote. Do not take the budget for the nation and the budget for our social security as hostages. The results on Thursday, however, were largely expected after Mr. Lecornu offered this week to delay an unpopular pension overhaul that gradually raised the legal age of retirement to 64 from 62. That move was a major concession to the moderate left-wing Socialist Party, whose support Mr. Locarno needed to ensure the no-confidence motions would not pass. The government of Mr. Locarno, a centrist and close ally of President Emmanuel Macron, is France's fourth in less than a year, and the latest in a succession of unstable center-right minority cabinets appointed by an increasingly unpopular Mr. Macron. Locarno resigned last week after less than a month in office, only to be reappointed just days later, which angered opponents who wanted Mr. Macron to call snap legislative elections or step down. The French president has firmly ruled out resigning, but he threatened to call new elections if Mr. Locarno was toppled. The government's survival on Thursday averted that outcome, but the respite could be short-lived. Mr. Locarno must now get a budget passed in a cantankerous lower house, where the main forces, an assortment of divided left-wing parties, a tenuous centrist coalition, a reduced conservative party, and a far-right bloc, agree on very little. Additional no-confidence votes are likely in the coming weeks and months. Parliamentary debate on the budget, which must conclude before the end of the year, could see a confrontation between the government and the Socialist Party, who disagree on how to reduce France's deficit. Other left-wing parties say the socialists were foolish to prop up Mr. Locarno's government in exchange for the pension overhaul delay, since it might not even survive budget discussions. All of you who were elected to repeal the pension reform, are you really going to let yourselves be fooled by this misleading handout? Auriel Trouvé, a lawmaker from the France Unbowed party, asked the lower house before the vote. In a sign of internal tensions, seven lawmakers who belong to or are affiliated with the Socialist Party broke ranks on Thursday and voted in favor of the no-confidence motion. The party's leadership insists that it will keep Mr. Locarno to his word and defend measures like a new wealth tax. If commitments are not honored, I am thinking in particular of the pension overhaul, we will immediately censure them, Olivier Faure, head of the Socialist Party, told reporters at the National Assembly after the vote. Vatican panel says church is still too slow in addressing sexual abuse. The commission's report highlights the difficulties Pope Leo faces in trying to end clerical abuses and ensure abusers are held to account. By Elisabetta Povoledo. A Vatican commission set up to address the clerical sexual abuse crisis said on Thursday that the Roman Catholic Church was still too slow in addressing a problem that has plagued it for decades. The commission called on church leaders to act more quickly and more transparently, and recommended that the church listen to and involve survivors as it worked to build trust after decades of scandal. Many times I have asked myself that same question, why so slow? Monsignor Luis Manuel Ali Herrera, the commission's secretary, said at a news conference to present its latest report on the church's progress in dealing with abuse. Sometimes I admit that I have been discouraged because I wanted the change to be more obvious, more radical. But, he added, many bishops around the world were now actively working with the commission, a marked change from the pattern when it was established 11 years ago. The latest report comes just months into the papacy of Leo XIV and underlines the challenges he will face. It covers 2024, before Leo was pope. Leo has met with commission members four times. Advocacy groups for clerical abuse survivors said that the report again revealed the church's shortcomings in dealing with the issue. Anne Barrett Doyle, co-director of bishopaccountability.org, issued a statement commending the commission for depicting how little progress the church has made in ending abuse and cover-up. She said the report should serve as a wake-up call to Pope Leo. She added that although the report was constructive, it was also inadequate and vague, a reflection of the limited power and remit of the commission itself. The panel did not deal with specific cases, for example, meaning it could not determine whether offenders had been removed from ministry, which critics say is crucial to stop the cycle of abuse. The focus of this year's report, the commission's second, was to push for more reparations beyond the financial payments now being given to some victims. The report said that the primary need for survivors was recognition of harm, genuine apologies, and meaningful action to prevent future abuses. Many survivors had complained to the commission that the church had often responded with empty settlements, performative gestures, and a persistent refusal to engage with them in good faith. But Matthias Koch, a survivor based in Germany, who was consulted for the report, said that more financial support was needed to help victims who often suffer lifelong limitations, including in terms of their professional activities and income. Many victims interviewed for the report said that their complaints of abuse had been ignored and that the church had often failed to provide access to information about their cases. One frustrated person, who was unnamed, was quoted as saying, "You want to know, and they don't tell you anything. It's like being sent to purgatory." The panel, the Pontifical Commission for the Protection of Minors, was formed in 2014 to advise Pope Francis on how to protect minors and vulnerable adults from sexual predators among the clergy. Its members include clergy, survivors, and independent outsiders, including some with law enforcement expertise. From the beginning, critics have complained that the commission has no enforcement powers. Reports to it from individual countries are still based mainly on self-reporting by bishops' groups, and compliance with questionnaires meant to explore how cases were handled was not universal, the commission said. In Italy, for example, only 81 of 226 dioceses answered the commission's questionnaire, the report noted, while in South Korea, all 15 dioceses complied. The overall findings suggest that more than two decades after the clerical abuse crisis exploded into the public sphere, the church's response remains mixed, despite efforts by Pope Benedict XVI and by Pope Francis to codify a response through new church laws. Although some progress has been made, victims' groups said that the Vatican had done too little to ensure that allegations had been properly investigated, that predators had been removed from their posts, and that those who covered up abuse had been held accountable. The report noted that in several countries, including Italy, Slovakia, and some in Africa, cultural resistance still hindered reporting of abuse. And Maud DeBoer Bucciccio, the report's chief writer, said that the church had not allocated enough money to set up centers to handle abuse cases. After the first report was issued last year, critics dismissed the findings given by individual countries, noting that they had not been verified by independent observers. The second report sought to rectify that by presenting notes about each country from the United Nations Committee on the Rights of the Child, as well as observations from Vatican ambassadors in each country and comments from personnel on the ground. The commission also said that it had spoken to victims to allow them to offer their reactions and perspectives on the accuracy and relevance of the commission's findings. But at least in the case of Italy, the commission had not reached out to Rete L'Abuso, the country's leading advocate for sexual abuse survivors, Francesco Zanardi, the group's founder and president, said. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. India tiptoes around Trump's latest claims on Russian oil purchases. The government subtly rebuffed the president's comments that it would stop buying Russian oil as it tries to avoid a public fight and end a trade dispute in Washington. By Mujib Mashal and Pragati KB. The Indian government on Thursday appeared to push back against President Trump's claim that the country would stop buying Russian oil without explicitly rejecting his comments, as it seeks to resolve a bruising trade dispute with Washington by avoiding a public confrontation. In a statement, India's foreign ministry made no mention of any such promise by Prime Minister Narendra Modi, but noted that the country had always sought a diverse range of suppliers for its oil imports. The non-confrontational response is a sign of how Mr. Modi is seeking to find a delicate resolution with the Trump administration to lift hefty U.S. tariffs in the hopes of restoring calm to a relationship with Washington that was carefully nurtured over two decades. On Wednesday, Mr. Trump said the Indian leader had assured me today that he will not be buying Russian oil, which his administration has said is fueling Russia's war in Ukraine. In August, the Trump administration imposed a 25% tariff on imports of Indian goods as punishment, on top of a 25% tariff it had already put in place. Radhir Jaiswal, the spokesman for the Indian Foreign Ministry, said in a news conference on Thursday that he had no knowledge of a call between the two leaders in recent days. But unlike a few months ago, when the government issued a firm pushback after Mr. Trump made a similar assertion about Russian oil purchases, Mr. Jaiswal walked a more careful line. Earlier, he had issued a statement that amounted to a denial without challenging the president directly. The statement said that India's oil imports were guided by a consistent priority to safeguard the interests of the Indian consumer in a volatile energy scenario. It added that the country had been diversifying as appropriate, including buying more oil from the United States. The ties between the country's two leaders, who had long touted their close bond, have been thorny during the second Trump administration. The relationship worsened after India denied Mr. Trump's claim that he had brokered a ceasefire between India and Pakistan after a military conflict between the countries this spring. Any admission that Mr. Modi called off his military operation under pressure from America would be politically risky to the Indian leader's strongman image at home. But Mr. Trump, who has been focused on his image as a peacemaker deserving the Nobel Prize, saw the denial as ungrateful. He narrowed in on India's purchases of Russian oil, which New Delhi has said were encouraged by American officials before Mr. Trump took office to keep market prices in check. The decision to impose the tariffs has all but grounded relations between the countries. Indian officials have described the tariffs as unfair, since other major importers of Russian oil, like China, have not faced similar penalties. If Trump wants India to behave a certain way, going public about it is the worst thing to do, said Harshvi Pant, a visiting professor of international relations at King's College London. It makes it difficult for a policymaker in a country like India to be seen to be towing a particular line under American pressure. In recent weeks, the two sides have focused on quiet diplomacy to try to get things back on track. The trade delegations have resumed negotiations, and Mr. Modi was among the first global leaders to celebrate Mr. Trump's role in brokering the hostage exchange deal between Israel and Hamas. The Indian leader called Mr. Trump on October 9th to congratulate him and to review the good progress achieved in trade negotiations. Sergio Gore, a Trump confidant who was recently confirmed as U.S. ambassador to India, made a four-day trip this month to the country ahead of starting his posting. He held meetings with Mr. Modi and other top officials, even though it is unconventional for an ambassador to do so before he has officially presented his credentials. S. Jaishankar, India's foreign minister, told a gathering in New Delhi this month that the two sides were working on resolving their outstanding trade issues so they do not percolate into every dimension of the relationship. "There are problems. There are issues. Nobody is in denial of it," Mr. Jaishankar said. "Those issues need to be negotiated and discussed and resolved, which is exactly what we are trying to do." Sanjeev Sanyal, a member of Mr. Modi's Economic Advisory Council, said India had chosen to stand its ground on its interests and not respond to snide remarks and sometimes what could be deemed as racist remarks against India by advisors of Mr. Trump. "We have in general been quite restrained," he told an economic forum this month. Indrani Bagshi, a foreign policy analyst and chief executive of the Ananta Aspen Center, a think tank in New Delhi, said Mr. Trump may be trying to exert leverage through his remarks. "If it's pressure tactics, I don't think India is going to fold," she said. After productive call, Trump plans another meeting with Putin. President Trump has come close to imposing penalties on Russia several times, only to backtrack after talking with President Vladimir Putin and raising hopes for a diplomatic solution to the war. By Zolan Kano-Youngs. After speaking for more than 2 hours on Thursday with President Vladimir V. Putin, President Trump said he planned to meet with the Russian leader in Hungary in 2 weeks or so to discuss ways to bring an end to Moscow's 3-year invasion of Ukraine. Mr. Trump held what he termed a productive call with his Russian counterpart a day before he was set to meet with President Volodymyr Zelensky of Ukraine, who is expected to make the case that the United States should give Kyiv weapons capable of striking deep inside Russia. But days after suggesting he would allow the sale of Tomahawk missiles to Kyiv, Mr. Trump abruptly expressed trepidation over further arming Ukraine, signaling that he might back off if Mr. Putin proves willing to negotiate a diplomatic end to the conflict. "We talked about it a little bit," Mr. Trump said, describing his discussion with Mr. Putin. "We need Tomahawks for the United States of America, too." Mr. Trump went on to say that Mr. Putin did not want him to provide the missiles. "Tomahawk is a vicious weapon," Mr. Trump said. "It's a vicious, offensive, incredibly destructive weapon. Nobody wants Tomahawk shot at them." The decision to hold the call with Mr. Putin after days of expressing his increasing frustration over the Russian leader's unwillingness to take substantive steps toward peace and on the eve of meeting with Mr. Zelensky signaled a familiar pattern for Mr. Trump's handling of the war. On multiple occasions this year, Mr. Trump has come right to the edge of imposing penalties on Russia or giving powerful new military aid to Ukraine, only to speak with Mr. Putin and raise hopes for a diplomatic solution, so far with little to show for it. In the spring, Mr. Trump accused Mr. Putin of playing with fire in his conduct of the war and said he was considering imposing sanctions on Russia, only to end up saying he needed 2 more weeks to know if Mr. Putin was serious about negotiations. He never imposed the sanctions. Mr. Trump set another deadline in early August for Mr. Putin to end the war. Rather than impose penalties, Mr. Trump met with the Russian leader in Alaska, emerging to proclaim that they had made headway toward peace. But Mr. Putin continued his assault on Ukraine and has shown little public willingness since then to back off. Mr. Trump's critics said he was again falling into a trap of rewarding Mr. Putin with a summit meeting without being assured of getting anything in return, allowing Russia to keep delaying and fighting the war on its terms. After walking away from his Alaska summit with Putin empty-handed, President Trump has now decided to reward Putin again by rolling out the red carpet in Hungary, said Senator Jeanne Shaheen of New Hampshire, the top Democrat on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. "President Trump is repeating the mistakes of the past by not arming Ukraine to the teeth and letting them win this war. Now he is taking it a step further by rewarding Putin while Ukraine gets nothing." But the decision to engage again with Mr. Putin showed how emboldened Mr. Trump is feeling when it comes to his handling of conflicts overseas. Having achieved what appears to be a substantial victory in bringing about a ceasefire and hostage deal between Israel and Hamas in Gaza, Mr. Trump is now throwing himself again into peacemaking in Ukraine, while also speaking openly about military action against Venezuela. "We hope we're going to get it stopped," Mr. Trump said of the Ukraine war. "Because of my relationship with President Putin, I thought this would be very quick. Who would think I did Middle East before I did this?" Mr. Trump added. After his meeting with Mr. Zelensky at the White House on Friday, Mr. Trump said he will send his senior advisors, including Secretary of State Marco Rubio, to meet with Mr. Putin's senior officials. Yuri Yushakov, an aide to Mr. Putin, told Russian news agencies that envoys from the two countries would meet without delay to lay the groundwork for the summit. Mr. Trump then is expected to meet with Mr. Putin in Budapest in a summit hosted by Prime Minister Viktor Orban of Hungary. "Their aim," Mr. Trump said in a social media post, "will be to see if we can bring this inglorious war between Russia and Ukraine to an end." But the meeting with Mr. Putin is far from a sure thing, according to foreign policy experts, who cautioned that it is likely hinged on the success of the meeting with Mr. Trump's and Mr. Putin's senior officials. "I can easily see it falling apart as they grapple with the actual issues," said John E. Herbst, a former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine and now senior director of the Atlantic Council's Eurasia Center. But Mr. Herbst also said it is notable that Mr. Trump has decided to lean into the conflict. "Trump has said since before he was elected he wants endurable peace," Mr. Herbst said. "He has put his reputation behind that concept. To allow himself to be played by Putin indefinitely doesn't serve his interests." Before talking to Mr. Putin on Thursday, Mr. Trump blamed the Russian leader for the continuous attacks on Ukraine that have undercut his efforts to broker peace. He has also emphasized the difficulty of negotiating with Mr. Putin, even suggesting that Mr. Putin has at times misled him and his senior aides. "I'm very disappointed because Vladimir and I have a very good relationship. Probably still do," Mr. Trump said on Tuesday at the White House. "I don't know why he continues with this war." But he struck a much more cordial tone after his call with Mr. Putin on Thursday. He said the Russian leader had congratulated him on his diplomatic efforts in the Middle East. Mr. Trump said he believed his success in negotiating a ceasefire and hostage release in Gaza would help him in brokering an end to the fighting in Ukraine. He added that Mr. Putin had expressed gratitude for the work of Mr. Trump's wife, Melania, who has held talks with Mr. Putin in an effort to secure the return of Ukrainian children taken by Russia and separated from their families during the war. "He was very appreciative and said that this will continue," Mr. Trump said in his post. "We also spent a great deal of time talking about trade between Russia and the United States when the war with Ukraine is over." William B. Taylor, a former U.S. ambassador to Ukraine, said the administration was at risk of repeating a familiar cycle with Mr. Putin. "Here we go again," Mr. Taylor said after reading Mr. Trump's summary of his call with Mr. Putin. "We can hope that we've learned how Putin works. There's no sign that Putin is interested in ending this war," he said, adding that he hoped Mr. Trump could put pressure on Mr. Putin like he was able to with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel. You are listening to a reading of articles and features from the New York Times on the Niagara Frontier Radio Reading Service. Nestle to slash 16,000 jobs in cost-cutting push. The company's new chief executive, Philippe Navratil, announced the reductions as part of a plan to turn around the world's largest food company. By Melissa Eddy. The global food giant Nestle said on Thursday that it would shed about 16,000 jobs over the next 2 years, accelerating a cost-cutting program 6 weeks after the company fired its chief executive. Philippe Navratil, who took over as chief executive last month, announced the changes as part of a wider move to cut 3 billion Swiss francs, or $3.7 billion in spending, by 2027. A previous plan called for 2.5 billion francs in cuts over the same time frame. "The world is changing and Nestle needs to change faster," Mr. Navratil said in a statement. "This will include making hard but necessary decisions." Nestle, which counts Nespresso, KitKat, Toll House, and Purina among its 2,000 brands, is based in Switzerland and employs some 277,000 people around the globe. It said increased automation and shared services among divisions would compensate for the lost workers. "The cuts will affect workers around the world, with 12,000 of them in white-collar jobs," the company said. Nestle has been seeking to cut costs in the face of stalling growth and a drop in demand from China, which has led to increased pressure from investors. President Trump's sweeping tariffs on imports to the United States, including a tariff of 39% on Swiss goods, added further challenges. The United States is Nestle's largest market. Mr. Navratil vowed to move Nestle forward by being rigorous in our approach to resource allocation, prioritizing the opportunities and businesses with the highest potential returns. Analysts welcomed the renewed zeal. It comes as multinational consumer products companies like Nestle are facing challenges like the jump in prices of raw materials such as coffee and cocoa beans, as well as a shift in consumer preferences away from processed foods. They praised Mr. Navratil for going in the right direction and for his strong focus on resource allocation, innovation, and a performance mindset. On Thursday, the company reported a 4.3% increase in sales for the third quarter, driven by higher prices and overall sales volume. Nestle maintained its growth outlook for 2025, expecting an improvement in sales from the previous year despite the negative effects of tariffs and exchange rates, which include a weakening of the U.S. dollar. A CIA secret kept for 35 years is found in the Smithsonian's vault. Jim Sanborn is auctioning off the solution to Kryptos, the puzzle he sculpted for the intelligence agency's headquarters. Two fans of the work then discovered the key. By John Schwartz. The sculptor Jim Sanborn opened his email account one day last month expecting the usual messages from people claiming to have solved his famous decades-old puzzle. Mr. Sanborn's best-known artwork, Kryptos, sits in a courtyard at the CIA headquarters in Virginia. A sculpture that evokes and incorporates secrets, Kryptos displays four encrypted messages in letters cut through its curving copper sheet. Since the agency dedicated it in 1990, cryptographers, both professional and amateur, have solved three of the passages, known as K1, K2, and K3. But the fourth, K4, remained stubbornly uncracked. Mr. Sanborn, who is 79, was in the final stages of auctioning off the puzzle's solution. The auction house had estimated that the text of that passage, along with other papers and artifacts related to the sculpture, would bring between $300,000 and $500,000. He has said he intends to use the proceeds to help manage medical expenses for a possible health crisis and to fund programs for people with disabilities. But the email he received on September 3rd threatened that plan. Its subject line contained the first words of the final passage of K4. The body of the email showed the rest of the solved text. What led to that moment is a blend of mishandled paperwork and nerdy spycraft. An amateur cryptographer and his friend had found the solution in plain view for anyone willing to dig through the archives of the Smithsonian Institution. The hidden text had been uncovered with potentially damaging effects for the sale. What is the value of a secret that someone else knows? The person who tracked down the solution, Jared Kobeck, is a journalist and novelist long fascinated by Mr. Sanborn's work. In the announcement from RR Auction, the company running the sale, he saw a reference to copies of the coding charts used to encrypt the message. The originals, it said, were at the Smithsonian. Mr. Kobeck lives in California, so he asked a friend in the Washington area, Richard Byrne, a journalist and playwright, to request the Sanborn papers at the Smithsonian's Archives of American Art. Mr. Byrne spent hours photographing documents at the archives on September 2nd. Mr. Kobeck, that evening, while reviewing the images his friend sent, saw scraps of paper, some held together by yellowed tape, and got a shock. "Hey, that says Berlin clock." Those two words were clues to K4 that Mr. Sanborn released in 2010 and 2014. Another scrap had more of what looked like the original uncoded message, known in cryptography as the plain text, including the words East Northeast, two clues released in 2020. Together, there were 97 characters, the number of characters in K4, that he assembled into a readable message. "This is a problem everybody has been attacking as a STEM problem," Mr. Kobeck said in an interview, referring to the fields of science, technology, engineering, and mathematics that underlie cryptography. Cryptographic science, he argued, could not solve Kryptos, but library science could. Mr. Byrne compared their find to open source intelligence. On September 3rd, the men sent their email to Mr. Sanborn, including an assurance that their primary concern was moving forward without imperiling your forthcoming auction. They had a half-hour telephone call in which Mr. Sanborn confirmed that they had the solution. Mr. Kobeck recalled it as a perfectly lovely conversation. But later that evening, a second conversation took a sobering turn, Mr. Kobeck recalled. He said Mr. Sanborn proposed they should both sign NDAs, and they could then receive a portion of the auction's proceeds. But Mr. Kobeck and Mr. Byrne said they had to reject the offer, in part out of fear that it would make them party to fraud in the auction, Mr. Kobeck said. Mr. Kobeck and Mr. Byrne suggested to him that there should be a way to disclose the fact that the last panel solution had been discovered while still holding the auction. The call ended at an impasse. Mr. Sanborn did not want them to talk, and they were offended by his suggestion that they sign an agreement to stay silent. The offer of money also rankled. "It's a complete red line," Mr. Byrne said. "Non-starter, not happening." Mr. Sanborn explained in an interview that he created the paper scraps the men had found to share the text with the CIA. He had mistakenly included them in the folders he gathered about 10 years ago. This happened during his treatment for metastatic cancer. I was not sure how long I would be around, and I hastily gathered all of my papers together for the archives, he said. He was stunned to realize years later that the scraps had ended up in the collection. Mr. Sanborn has since exchanged messages with Mr. Kobach and Mr. Byrne, but they have not broken through to a solution. In parallel, on the largest internet forum for crypto enthusiasts, the auction catalog had indicated a discussion of the Smithsonian Trove. On September 5th, a member noted that the documents had been sealed and were no longer accessible. That was the work of Mr. Sanborn, who, after talking with Mr. Kobach and Mr. Byrne, had gotten the institution to block access to the materials until 2075. Mr. Sanborn said that his initial reaction to the email and calls from Mr. Kobach and Mr. Byrne was frazzled. "I didn't know their motives," he said. He recalled telling them, "If you release that thing, the auction is over." Mr. Kobach, long a fan of Mr. Sanborn's work, said he was devastated by the events of recent weeks. "If I had known, my God, I never would have sent Rich to this library," he said. Mr. Kobach and Mr. Byrne initially told Mr. Sanborn that they were willing to keep the text private to avoid disrupting the auction. But in interviews, they said the weight of keeping the secret in the superheated world of Kryptos fans is too great and worried they would be compelled to release the plain text. Mr. Sanborn acknowledged that keeping the secret could be a strain. His computer has been hacked repeatedly over the years, he said, and obsessed fans of the work have threatened him. "I sleep with a shotgun," he said. "If the two men reveal the text," he warned, "that is going to be far worse," he said. "The world of Kryptos is going to attack them," he said. "They are going to be pariahs for releasing it. The auction house is not sitting idly by." Last week, Mr. Kobach and Mr. Byrne received an email from lawyers for RR Auction that threatened legal action if they published the text, citing copyright infringement and interference with contracts. In a very different tone, the letter also stated that if the two didn't publish the text, you will be looked upon as heroes to the cipher and intelligence communities, a storyline their client would happily help you promote. Both men find the legal reasoning dubious and have hired lawyers, but they also acknowledge the crushing cost of defending themselves. They say they do not plan to release the solution, but they are also not inclined to sign a legally binding document promising not to do so. Bidding is to begin on Thursday and close on November 20th. The auction house has disclosed the discovery of the solution on their website. Thomas C. Danzinger, a lawyer who represents clients in the art market, said that as long as the message remained a secret, such a disclosure is the best practice. And while presumably that would have an impact on the value of the sale, that still should be cheaper than facing litigation from a disgruntled buyer down the line. Mr. Danzinger said that revealing the plain text could have a profound impact on the auction. But while revealing the plain text could dampen bidders' enthusiasm, he said, the auction room is a strange place. He cited a famous example, an artwork by Banksy that destroyed itself after being sold for $1.4 million at Sotheby's in London, which only served to increase its value substantially. In the case of Kryptos, the secret is being shredded before the eyes of the world, he said. Does that mean it has less value or more value? I don't know. Ilanka Dunnan, a game designer who helps lead the most active online discussion about Kryptos, said in an interview that she hoped the text didn't get out. But for true lovers of cryptographic skill, she said, the real challenge is not having the answer, but knowing how to get there. That's the exciting part for me, and she proposed the real value at auction. If they don't have the method, she said, it's not solved. You've been listening to a reading of articles and features from the Friday, October 17th issue of the New York Times. Your reader has been Chris Wilhelm. Thank you for listening.